You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Madeline Tichnor. Madeline is an agent and assistant at Janklow and Nesbitt and is interested in fiction that bridges the gap between commercial and literary. She likes upmarket thrillers and grounded speculative stories that explore the ideas of family and home, and queer stories too. She's also looking for select narrative nonfiction. In 2022, Madeline joined Janklow and Nesbitt Associates, where she works with senior agent PJ Mark and is actively building her own list. Prior to publishing, she worked in a children's library, at ad agencies, and as a barista in coffee shops around New York City. On the show, we talked about the dreaded synopsis and how agents and editors use them. The query letter, comps, how perfect a manuscript needs to be for her to take it on, mistakes writers make, and so much more. And now for my talk with Madeline Tichnor. Madeline, I'm so happy to have found you and happy that you agreed to be on the show. To begin, will you talk about how you found your way to agenting?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here. So when I first graduated college, I knew I wanted to work in books, but I didn't know kind of what the possibilities were. And I found myself working in a children's library, which I quickly realized wasn't the right setting for me. And I actually, the way I found myself in agenting is very like serendipitous. I was at a party and there was a book scout there, and I was kind of talking to her about how hard it was to get an internship, and you know, I had applied to work at the publishing houses but didn't hear back from any of them, and she was like, well, you should try applying for an internship at an agency because there's fewer there's more agencies than there are publishing houses, and there's probably fewer people applying to the agency positions. So I did that, and that's how I wound up with my first agenting internship, which led to my first agenting job, which led to my next agenting job, which led to where I am now. So I kind of fell into agenting through a tip and realized that I really liked it and that it's working for me. So
yeah. I wonder if that would have happened if you were in New York, I take it.
Yeah, I was already in New York.
Yeah, I wonder how that would have gone if you hadn't been in New York, you know? I mean, because it seems like, you know, so much, you know, there's still agents all over the country and the world, but New York is center, you know?
I don't know. Like, I think that, and most agencies, I feel like, are probably in New York. There are plenty that are scattered around the country, but I don't know if I would have run into a book scout who told me to apply for an agency anywhere else besides New York. Yeah, probably pretty serendipitous.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, and I went to school in Portland, Oregon, so, and moved to New York just to follow my boyfriend at the time. So kind of... Yeah, just I wouldn't say that it like that I fell into this, because I applied for like so many jobs, and I had a spreadsheet with like where I had applied and who responded, and I was very like anal about applying for jobs. So I didn't like fall into my lap, but I think it fell into place the way that it needed to.
Sounds like what writers go through, right?
yeah, probably a lot of rejection.
A lot of rejection.
Until I found the right thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk about what you represent, what you especially look for in fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah. So Well, I'm at a point in my career, which is to say pretty early in my career. And so I feel like I'm still kind of figuring out exactly what I'm looking for. And I'm open to a huge array of things because of that. Like I haven't fallen into a niche yet. On the fiction side, I'm definitely looking for things that kind of bridge the gap between commercial and literary, kind of that upmarket book clubby space. I'm realizing I've taken on a few things that are kind of like I would say elevated sci-fi, which I'm surprised at because I didn't, I wouldn't think of myself as like an avid sci-fi reader, but I'm realizing that as I read submissions that come in that are sci-fi, I'm like really loving it and finding myself signing them on. And probably the same with kind of like thriller and like especially domestic suspense. I'm realizing that I really enjoy that space. So definitely looking for upmarket literary domestic suspense and thriller and grounded sci-fi that like definitely leans literary, like a literary with a sci-fi bent as opposed to like in the genre of sci-fi, if that makes sense. And then on the nonfiction side, I'm looking for narrative nonfiction that kind of takes something that seems like it would be kind of a boring, mundane topic and deep dives into it, and kind of opens it up, opens a very like specific topic up into something that like many readers would find interesting and relatable, surprisingly. Like I read this book over the summer, about parking and how like parking lots have shaped how America has developed, basically. And it was so interesting and entertaining. And like, as someone who doesn't give a lot of thought to city planning, it's not like I set out to find a book on parking because I'm obsessed with it, but someone recommended it to me and I really enjoyed it. And so something like that that takes a topic that might not seem accessible and turns it into something that like a wide audience would be interested in reading about and teach that audience about the world and like that, realize that it's important and relatable, if that makes sense. And I think that I'm looking for kind of a list that is like 60-40 fiction to nonfiction. So just a little more fiction than nonfiction.
So I'm curious, how, like, you get a submission and you have to judge. I mean, probably immediately you know whether or not this could possibly be for you. I mean, like, I would think right away, like, some things just go out the window because it's not your genre, it's not to your taste. But then how much of what you decide to take on has to do with what readers are buying? I mean, does that enter into it? Like, I really like this, but readers are not into this particular subgenre of whatever it is right now. Or, I love this and I don't care if nobody's buying it, they're going to buy this. Like, where does sort of the marketplace enter into what you take on?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I feel like it comes more into play when the market is kind of already saturated with something, more than if it hasn't been done, obviously we don't know if readers are gonna love it. So if it's really fresh and totally unlike anything else, I would be more likely to maybe try to take that risk, even though I don't see that it like it reflected in the marketplace that it's already succeeded. But if it's something that there's a million books about it already, and it's kind of a trend that has come and gone, I'm less likely to feel that it's like fresh and exciting. So I think it's less about like what is gonna sell, and I think like more just organically, like if it's fresh and really good, it probably is going to sell. And if it's not fresh and has been done already a lot, then it's not going to sell. Like the marketplace is going to reflect that too, if that makes sense.
So then, of course, that brings us to the query letter, which All agents seem to want comps, right? At the in the first paragraph, I suppose. And so if something, if there's nothing like it and it's fresh, there may not be any comps. And then what does the writer do? Do they look for, say, I don't know, style or tone, or readers of this would might like this, but do you know what I mean? Like comps seem to be such a big part of the query letter these days.
Yeah, totally. They're a huge part of the query letter and a huge part of the life of the book. Like even when an agent is sending it out to editors and when the editors are pitching it to their sales teams, comps are coming into play throughout that whole life cycle. And even when booksellers are like, arranging the books on the tables, it's kind of like alongside their comps. And I think when I'm having trouble picking comps, for a book that I'm going out on submission with, I tend to like zoom out a little and think, who would this book be for readers of? So it's not like this book is just like similar plot and subject matter and everything, just like this other book, but it's like people who read this other book might enjoy this book. And then I also tend to find myself taking like one element of one book. So like with the humor of book X and the social commentary of book Y. So it's like it could be totally different, but I'm still pulling in, I'm still giving like signifiers of who the book is for and how the book is kind of going to be aligned on like the contemporary marketplace of books.
So in a query letter, then if the comps in that first paragraph are not to your liking, will you still read on and read the sort of the summary or the synopsis paragraph to see if how you feel about it? Or will the comps just like go, no, that's not for me?
No, I think that I'll definitely read the full letter. Just because it doesn't seem fair. And often I think that a lot of writers are really bad at picking comps for their own book.
They're true.
Just because they're so close to their book. And so I'll still read the query letter and think, oh, actually, it actually sounds like this book, which I really like. So I'll read the sample pages or whatever.
Speaking of synopsis, I mentioned the synopsis paragraph, which really is not a synopsis, but a longer synopsis, say a two-page synopsis. My query tracker and query manager, I've noticed, ask for that in the form. First they want the query letter and, pitch the book, a log line, and paste the synopsis. And I'm curious how many agents actually read synopses. Like, the agents I talk to seem like, well, we don't really read them. So then why do you have to write one? So
Yeah.
what do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I have been an assistant for about 5 years for a bunch of different agents who use synopses differently, I think. So, one way that it seems they come in handy is, you read the most likely when you send in a query to an agent, the first person reading it is probably their assistant. And if they like it, they're gonna do a report on it and hand it in to the agent and say, here's what the book is about, and here's a synopsis, and here's why I liked it. So in that sense, I think the synopsis comes in handy when like the assistant is kind of pitching the book to the agent, and they can get it there to their agent faster if the synopsis is already written. So that's one way it comes in handy. I think that it's just a way for agents to like look at the book, and if the writing is really good, and they read the synopsis and the plot just goes like completely out to left field, they can see, oh, like this isn't going to be for me because this plot, like, it becomes, it starts as memoir and then becomes fantasy halfway through, and that's just not my style. They can kind of expedite their response. But some agents don't require a synopsis. So I haven't ever used the query manager. So I think that a lot of agents and agencies will have different and varying, guidelines for submitting. Like at Janklow and Nesbitt, we just usually ask for the first 10 pages and we don't tend to ask for a synopsis. So it kind of, I think, depends agency to agency. And I don't think anyone would ask for a synopsis specifically if they weren't going to use it somehow.
In some way.
Yeah.
So then, okay, so the first 10 pages, how far will you read to know, like, I would imagine that you would know by the end of the first page whether this is something that is interesting to you or whether you like the writing or whatever. I mean, I understand reading the entire query letter because it's out of courtesy or respect that you're going to do that. But then here you have the pages and you have like a million other queries. You have a million other 10 pages. Like, how far will you read?
It depends on what I think of, like, basically the first sentence or like the first paragraph. This might come as a shock, but the more I like, the more I'll keep reading. But I think that actually, if I really like something and I love the style, I can tell within a page and I'll request the full pretty quickly. If I, you know, I like the pitch, I like the log line and the premise of the book, I think the writing is good, I want to read the whole thing. Or definitely more than the first 10 pages. So I'll request the full. If I don't know, I might read more if I can't get a sense of whether I like the writing or not. But I don't know. I think I do read for the most part the full 10 pages. Because if I want the full, I'm going to be reading that anyway. And unless it's like the writing is like really bad, which in that case I might be able to tell just from the query letter, then I want to get the full sense before I say no.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, you know, I mentioned the million things, the million queries, and the million 10 pages that you have that I imagine all agents these days have. I just can't imagine how you manage it all. But I'm curious how different agents manage their queries, and, you know, how they manage, like, keeping track, I guess. I mean, do you have like a system? Do agents have a system so that, I mean, I know, again, Query Tracker, Query Manager, some agents use that because it helps keep them organized. But when you don't use those systems, how do you keep it organized?
I use a system. It's kind of like a twofold system where I have a spreadsheet. And once I request a full, I put the title, you know, I log it on my spreadsheet, and with any other notes that may be relevant, like if they were directed to me by a friend of mine or another writer who I really love, I'll mark that just so I have it. And then if they get back to me 2 days later and say, I just got an offer of representation, I'll mark that on the spreadsheet too. So I know to prioritize it. And then I also, in my inbox, have a reading folder where I have it split up into partials and what I've requested the full of, and stuff like that. So I kind of keep it organized in two different places, and I still lose track of things. So, but it seems to work for the most part.
So, say someone does write to you, a writer, a student says, I just had a, an offer or whatever. How do you know if they're telling the truth? I mean, it might get you to move on something, but how do you even know? Because I'm sure they're not going to say such and such agency offered whatever. Like, how do you know?
I think I'm just gonna believe them if they tell me. I have never gotten that message and questioned it. I think that would drive me crazy. So I just have to assume that people are honest, and I'll look at, I might be more quick to look at the query, but I'm not gonna be more likely to offer on something just because there's an offer in. So if it is like the writing is just like illegible, and they say they have an offer because they're lying, like I'm gonna be like, well, I don't know who's offering, but I'm not interested in this in any case. So yeah, I've never questioned it though.
And I guess from the query, you can't really tell what the writing of the work would be like, right? I mean, I don't know. I do writers try to do use gimmicks or are cute with the query letter and an effort to interest you? Or are they always do they tend to be pretty businesslike and
I think that there is definitely a genre of query letter that is like more cute or gimmicky. I tend to gravitate towards the letters that are just more straightforward, just because I read so many that I mean, if there is real genuine humor, I'll appreciate it. But if it's just there, if there's like some funny gimmicky thing, I don't want to say I would get annoyed by it, but I kind of just want to get the straight, the straight query letter, and to know that the writer is taking this really seriously and that they respect their own work as well as my time, if that makes sense.
And how important are referrals? You mentioned referrals earlier. Referrals, do you find authors in the slush pile?
You may have noticed on my publisher's marketplace that I'm closed to unsolicited queries right now. But if you're listening to this podcast, you can assume that I have solicited your query and you can feel free to query me. But right now, I'm pretty much only open to solicited manuscripts and referrals just because I'm also still assisting and I have a massive reading load between what I'm reading for myself and for my boss. And I think I am just right now open to people who are kind of doing the research and have found me through, listening to a podcast like this or through like a network of writers. And so for me, referrals are pretty important. And I think I hope someday to open myself up to all unsolicited queries. Right now, I just don't think I have the bandwidth for it. Because I writers tend to find me. There's no there's no shortcoming of manuscripts to read, despite being closed to unsolicited queries. So.
Well, you mentioned sort of categories you're interested in. And how important is it that in that first paragraph, a writer says what category their book is in, if it's fiction? Do they need to say it's upmarket, it's literary fiction? And if they consider it book club fiction, should they just say that? And is that meaningful, or should that not be used as a category?
I think this question of genres seems to come up a lot, and a lot of different people probably have different ideas about it. For me, upmarket and book club feel pretty much synonymous. So you could say one or the other. I do tend to appreciate having the genre right up there at the top of the query letter, just so I kind of have a framework for what I'm reading for, and knowing how the author kind of views their work is helpful in knowing kind of what to look for in the query letter. So I do appreciate the genre. That being said, like if you are sending a query letter and you if your genre if you don't get the genre right for whatever reason, it wouldn't like turn me off necessarily. But I just find it can be helpful as I like evaluate the query and the letter.
How would you define upmarket?
For me, I mean that's a kind of tough question again, and lots of people will have different answers, but I think that like literary writing, well, and plot driven. So the writing has to be kind of at a literary level, but it has to have kind of like a motor. Like I think of Angie Kim as an example of a writer who's like very much upmarket. Like the writing is just stunning and poetic and so clean. But it's like mystery and thriller, and it really moves, and there's a story that you can get sucked into and just turn the pages.
Before we bring Madeline back on, a few words about Patreon. If you've been listening to the show for a while, then you know Patreon is how you can help Marie and me to bring the show to you. Perks include giving us questions you'd like us to ask authors or agents, prompts, and writing tips. Our Patreon page is at patreon.com/writersonwriting. Buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting also helps us and indie bookstores. On our page, you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as books Marie and I recommend. And now more with Madeline Ticknor. What about word counts? Because it seems like novels are, well, this might be a generalization, but shorter. Something, or maybe it's just the novels I like tend to be on the shorter side versus the big doorstop kind of novel.
Yeah, that's a really good question too. I've also noticed that. And I think that I could be totally wrong. This is just me kind guessing about what's going on. But I think, well, on the publishing side, people are so busy, and a lot of people would like, working on a 200,000 word book is really time consuming and hard. And I wonder if editors are just intimidated by that. But I also think readers are too. And people tend to maybe gravitate towards like shorter. I love the sweet spot of like 65 to 75,000 words, which I think is probably just slightly less. It's probably like 250 pages. I don't know off the top of my head how it translates to page numbers, but yeah, I think I am intimidated by books that are more than like 100,000 words. So I'll still give them a chance, but I'll be weary, definitely.
Yeah, and plus on the reading side, there's so many books, so many good books
Yeah.
out that, so many books to read that, you see these long books and you just go, how am I going to read that plus read, these others? I mean, I have this huge book that's sitting here that must be 800 pages that I want to read, but there's all this other material.
Yeah.
And I imagine as agents and, it's just, it's more magnified.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
So I also wanted to ask you about research. Like, writers are told to, research your agent, the agent you're querying, so that, when you talk with them, should you talk with them, you have meaningful questions. I'm curious if agents research writers. Like, you get a query, you get the 10 pages, you like it. Will you look up the writer before you ask for a full? Or after you get the full, after you read the full? I mean, at what point are you interested in, how what they say online or how active they are, all of that, who they are?
Yeah, I think it depends again. Like sometimes I'll be reading something and I'll be 20 pages in and then it'll be like so good and I'll be like, who is this person? And I'll look them up just because I'll be like, wow, like how do they not have an agent? I do tend to look up everybody who I read the full manuscript and want to offer, like before I reach out to them to have a call, I'll look them up. And it kind of depends if someone like in their bio has a ton of bylines and is just published in really interesting places and has an interesting bio. I'll look them up just out of curiosity, I guess. Sometimes even to see if we have like mutual friends. So it kind of just depends on how energized I'm feeling by what I'm reading.
Are you concerned with, like, if they're on Instagram or Facebook, how many friends or followers they have? Is that meaningful? Or because you can buy followers now, right? I mean, you can pay however much and get 20 million followers.
For me, I don't really pay. I'm not on Facebook and I'm not on Instagram professionally. Although I do help out with the Jinklo Nesbitt Instagram, but I'm not really looking on Facebook or Instagram. I probably will look, like I am on Twitter, so that's where I'm gonna look people up. But if they don't have, I don't even know what is a lot of followers, but if they don't have 100,000 followers, it's not gonna be a turn off to me whatsoever. It's kind of more just if I look them up and they're tweeting like terrible things, that's a really good signifier of whether I'm not I want to work with them. Probably not. But if they're not like a celebrity on Twitter, that's okay. I think it also makes a difference whether it's fiction or nonfiction. For nonfiction, I am kind of going to want to see that who is querying me is kind of an expert in their field. If it's, not as much for memoir, obviously, but for other narrative nonfiction, I want to see that they are engaged in what they're talking about in that community.
Speaking of memoir, are you are it, does memoir have to be pretty much the same as fiction? It has to be finished before you query, or do you take memoirs on partials? We sign someone on a partial.
Generally, no. I would want to see the full memoir. It's a genre that is funny because it kind of follows the rules of fiction despite being nonfiction. And obviously there are exceptions. But for the most part, I would want to see the full because a memoir is so much about the writing, like it actually is kind of following the rules of fiction more than other types of nonfiction. So,
Right. Okay, so back to comps, because I forgot to ask you this, and that is, can comps be film or TV shows as well as books? And how far back can they go? Is it like 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, or does it just depend on what it is? What the book, maybe there is a book that came out 10 years ago that's perfect, that did well, that is a perfect comp, but is that too long? Just, film, TV, time.
So I think this is another question that a lot of agents feel differently about. But I kind of like to see film and TV and various mediums. I think you shouldn't comp only to film. Like you should comp to a book and a film if you're going to comp to a film. But I really don't have a problem with comping to film. And as far as how current, again, I think it's important to pair. If you are going to choose an older book, it should be, I think, a very like iconic and big book. Like, I don't think you should comp to a book that didn't really make a splash 30 years ago and nobody's talking about now. If you choose like a big iconic book, pair it with something that makes it feel a little more contemporary, or you can say like, this is like the millennial heartburn, or like, bringing an older work into the now and thinking about like reframing a comp to like a different audience in that way.
That's great. Yeah, that makes sense. And then how involved do you get with the manuscript before it goes to an editor? And how perfect does a manuscript have to be before it comes to you? I mean, does it, have to be so wonderful that all that maybe needs to be fixed are typos? I mean, what are you hoping for?
Well, I think of myself as a pretty editorial agent. I really like working with authors editorially. And I'm not going to turn a manuscript down because I think that there's work that needs to be done before I feel comfortable sending it out. Like, I'll take something on that that I feel is imperfect, but I kind of can see a way, a revision, to get it to a point where I would want to send it out. So it kind of depends on, some manuscripts I'll take on, and it is kind of just like a once over, more of an edit than a revision. And some things I'll take on, and there'll be a huge like year-long revision, and it kind of just depends on the project. And then I don't want to send something out until I really feel that it could be published. And then an editor is going to take it on and probably have, another year's worth of notes to give to the author. I'll get it to a point where I either it feels like there's nothing else that I can do to, there's no other advice I could give to improve it. Like, I've really done everything I can, and I've gotten to a point that I'm really, proud to represent it and send it out to editors.
Will you ask writers for R&Rs if it's not quite there, but you like it enough? I
I
mean,
do that
does that happen much?
sometimes. I think it does happen. I kind of, I'm cautious about it, again, because I am young in my career, and I feel that I've been in a lot of situations where an author has, decided to go with a more experienced agent than me, and I'm hesitant to give feedback before signing, and then for them to take that feedback and go and work with someone else. So I do it sometimes, but I tend to, I'll have a phone call with an author if I really love the work, but I think there's work to be done. I'll have a phone call and I'll let them know, kind of a general overview of the work that I feel needs to happen, and if that resonates with them and they want to do that work, then I'll sign them before like giving a real editorial like letter and working on a real revision.
So what if it's not right for you, whatever they've sent? Will you, but you think it's right for someone else in the agency, will you pass it on, or should they just assume you haven't talked about it with anybody else and query someone else in the agency?
If I just send a pass, then an author should definitely feel free to query someone else at the agency. With that being said, we do share a lot throughout JanClow and Nesbitt. It's actually, not that big of an agency, and we definitely share things. So someone will read something and it won't be quite right for them, or they'll just be too busy at that given time. And they'll circulate it to other agents. But we'll let you know if we're doing that. So you won't be in the dark.
What about if you say you send them a no and they're, they have another project or, whatever, another project. Should they interpret, like, if you haven't asked them to send, feel free to send me your next project. If you haven't asked for that, should they assume they should not query you ever again? Or is it, would you, is it fine? I mean, would you not say that anyway? And they should query you again. Like, rejection is a very difficult thing, or can be a very difficult thing to interpret. Like, do they hate me? Do they want to see anything else? How do I deal with other projects?
I am, if I reject something, you should absolutely feel free to send your next project to me, especially if we've, established this communication. We have an email rapport. I'm happy to take a look, and I might reject it again, but it might also be up my alley. I don't think you should ever assume that a rejection is means don't ever talk to me again. I think it does mean, like don't try me with this project again. But try me with another project, sure. And I think as an agent, we face rejection all the time from editors too. And if we assumed that those rejections were don't ever talk to me again, it'd be really hard to sell something. So, you just got to keep plugging away. And I feel like that is true for authors looking for agents too.
If you're a brand new writer, maybe you haven't been through an MFA program, you don't have much to put in the bio, maybe you don't have any publications. What do you do with that bio?
I think that I love seeing that people's other lived experience has influenced their writing. I think it's always super interesting if a novel takes place in, let's say, okay, this randomly came to me, so weird, but let's say it takes place in a meatpacking factory, and you worked in a meatpacking factory. That's really relevant information, and so that is something that you can include in your bio. So anything that's kind of lending itself to what makes this book special and unique to you is great to include. It doesn't need to be publications necessarily or an MFA. It could be you went to law school, and your book has a lawyer in it, so you have that dialogue really nailed down. So lived experience is important.
Do queries by MFA graduates carry more weight, or do you simply want to see that writers are engaged in a literary community?
I think
I
for
mean,
me, it's really important to see that a writer is engaged in a literary community more than what MFA program they went to. Actually, I think half of I have a small list, but half of it I don't think have MFAs, but are engaged in their writing community in some way or another, and have taken the time to form a community and spend time with writing in some way, even if it's not an MFA.
Do you want to hear if somebody has worked with a developmental editor in the query letter?
I think that if you have it, you might as well include it. So it again shows your kind of dedication, and just another way that you've engaged.
What mistakes do you see writers making at the querying level? Other than, dear occupant or dear editor, that, looks like it could have been
Or like addressing it to a different agent,
to
which I still read those query letters
anybody.
too, even if they're to an agent at another agency. But I think that one mistake I see a lot is authors kind of talking themselves down or being really modest. If you don't have, if you haven't had anything published and you haven't done an MFA, don't say, I've never had anything published and I don't have an MFA, but you should read my work anyway. Talk yourself up instead of down. If it feels like you don't even trust your writing or your experience, it's just, I don't want to waste my time if you don't even think you're a good writer. So don't be modest. I think that a lot of writers make that mistake because it's hard to kind of pump yourself up, and a lot of writers are very modest, but the query letter is not the place for that. So that's my answer for that.
What about titles? How important are titles? And is that something writers should work over to make sure they have like the best possible title? I mean, some writers say, ah, they're going to change it anyway. And I'm like, I think it's important, but I don't know. Is it important to you?
I mean, I think a really good title can definitely go a long way. A bad title isn't necessarily going to hurt you. And the chance of your title changing is very high. So I don't think an agent will ever not will ever delete a query, reject it just because they don't like the title. A good title could entice them and make them more excited more quickly, which is great. But it's also such a subjective thing. You might think you have the best title in the world, but the agent, it's going to be like their least favorite part about the query. So you really never know. So you should definitely choose. You should feel good about your title when you're sending it out, but also know that it's not the most important thing, and the chances of it changing are pretty high because it has to get past the agent, the editor, and then the sales team, which are the people who are really going to want to change the title, because to make it like searchable and stuff, there's a whole, a lot of qualifications.
And plus, there are certain titles that, you go on Amazon or Goodreads and there's so many books with that same title. So what if you think, well, this is a perfect title for my book, but there's 10 other books with the same title?
Yeah, I mean, you might want to choose a different title, if you're really set on it. I mean, I know of a book that I know of two books with the same title sold by the same agent, totally different. But we were joking that that agent now needs to sell a third book with that title. But I think having a unique title is a good thing. And the problem with having the same title as other books is that it's then going to be associated with those, and if it is totally different, you might not want it to be associated with those other titles. One other thing to think about is if your title is like one word, it's going to be really hard to search online. Like if your book is called Love, and then you type in love on Google, and your book's not going to be the first thing that pops up. So it's something to think about as well, even though those like one word snappy titles are great. But that's also something that at the query level, you don't really need to worry about.
What about word count of the query? Should it, definitely be under 400 words? Is there like a standard word count that makes you happy?
I don't pay attention to word count in the query letter. I think that, but I do pay attention to length. I think that it definitely should be no longer than like a page and a half is long for a query letter, like single spaced. So I think one page, which I guess is probably about 300 words, is like the sweet spot. And I wouldn't go much shorter than that because, you want to include enough information about you want to give that small synopsis in your bio, and if it's too brief, it just might not catch an agent's eye. But if it's too long, the agent is probably not going to read the whole thing. If it's like 4 pages long, they're going to be like, oh my gosh, why does this need to be 4 pages long? It probably doesn't. So I think a query letter really probably never actually needs to be longer than a page and a half, a page to a page and a half.
So we are drawing down on our time, but I wanted to also ask you a couple more things. One is you mentioned beginnings and how that first sentence should be strong and the first paragraph, need to be pretty solid. What about endings?
Those are very important too. I think that one thing I've kind of noticed in query letters and not letters, but in query submissions, the first like third will be super strong because an author has spent a lot of time revising that, and then you can kind of tell the ending just hasn't had as much development and thought put into it. It kind of can fall apart and that's always disappointing. So the ending is really important. I think that the last sentence is probably not as important as the first sentence, but I think the last image certainly is as important as the first image.
Yeah, that's good. I know I've read novels where the ending falls apart and I'm so disappointed. I never want to read anything else by this writer,
Yeah, it's disappointing. Yeah.
Likewise, a great ending, you're like, oh, I have to go on and find, read their next book or go
Yeah, or I
to
don't know how I'm ever going to read anything ever again because how can I move on from this? I'm
Right.
devastated.
How can I
Yeah.
move on? And the other thing was books you've loved. You mentioned the parking lot book. Does that have a title?
It does. It's called Paved Paradise, and the author is Henry Graybar or Graber, but it's Grabar. I loved that book. I loved, what else have I read recently that I loved? I read Birnam Wood by Eleanor Catton over the winter break, and that book blew me away. That's a book with an ending that I was just like, how am I going to move on from this? What else? I'm reading right now, Same Bed, Different Dreams by Ed Park, which is definitely on the more sci-fi end of the literary spectrum, and I'm feeling very challenged by it, but enjoying it a lot. It's definitely more sci-fi than I generally read, but I'm loving it and feeling like I'm having fun with it. So,
Are you a rereader? Will you reread books?
I can't say that I am. I feel like I just don't have time to. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the last book that I reread, and it's been a really long time, so I'm not a rereader.
Well, last words, anything, any tips or advice or pearls of wisdom that we haven't touched on that you have for the writers listening?
Yeah, I'll just say, don't give up for writers who are looking for agents. I think it can take a really long time. And this is what I tell myself all the time when I'm sending things out, and what I told myself when I was looking for a job too is you only fail when you give up. So you could pivot, that's different, but just don't give up. And yeah, just remember that everyone in the industry, we're all people too. And so it can seem kind of like a impenetrable machine, but it's not. And that's, I guess, another reason to kind of build community and see and kind of see the human side of this industry that, yeah, it can be complicated, but it's we're good people.
Well, I so appreciate your time. This has been a lot of fun for me, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a fun conversation for me too.
Was Madeline Ticknor. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire where I talk about writing and do interviews with authors and agents, many of whom have been on the show. It's under Pen on Fire. Thank you, Travis Barrett, for your music and sound editing. And if you like the music you hear on the show, you can find more typewriter music on Spotify. under the artist Just My Type. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. And if you'd like to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and in the meantime, stay in the chair.